Welcome to our discussion segment on civil rights in the Supreme Court. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. John, hello. How are you?
Hey. I'm good. How about you?
Doing just fine. What prompted this redux of a classic episode?
Well, as you may know, the Supreme Court was in the news over the summer and has been in the news even more recently with the affirmative action case that's coming up. And I thought it might be timely. We're interspersing some redux episodes. It won't always be one new, then one old. But I thought this was a good opportunity, plus with the election here, to kind of revisit a somewhat political topic, not expressly like endorsing candidates or anything like that, but just to kind of talk through some of the ideas that are an integral part in our democratic process. And another reason I chose this episode is just kind of as a follow-up to our interview with James Richardson a couple of weeks ago talking about his book. I thought this would be a nice follow-up to the discussion we had there. Oh.
John, I'm going to ask you a question that may seem basic, but I just want to clarify this at the beginning.
Joe, asking a basic question?
I know, I imagine
no.
That. All the jokes. What is the role of the Supreme Court as a branch of our government?
As the Founding Fathers originally intended, it is to interpret the law. Now, that's a very broad statement because the Constitution is not all that specific on the Supreme Court's role, except in very limited original jurisdiction cases. Basically, they hear mostly appellate cases from the lower courts. But in 1803, the Supreme Court kind of gave itself the power of judicial review, whereby it can review and either uphold or strike down the constitutionality of federal and later state and local laws. So that is its modern role in the federal government.
Okay. Can the Supreme Court enforce any of its rulings?
No.
Okay,
no,
explain that. Like, how does that work?
Well, no, it's each branch of government has a very distinct role, and it's the executive branch's job to enforce Supreme Court rulings and to enforce laws passed by Congress. In fact, in the, I believe it was in 1834, 35, in the early 1830s, President Andrew Jackson got a ruling that he didn't like from the Supreme Court about the Bank of the United States, and he famously said something to the effect of, Justice Marshall, the Supreme Court Chief Justice at the time, Justice Marshall has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. And he just ignored the Supreme Court's ruling and continued to do what he did.
Interesting.
Which is not conducive to a healthy constitutional system.
It is not. And he seemed to be very good at that, ignoring
Jackson?
Supreme Court. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the only time that he did it. And it's exceptionally rare for presidents to just outright ignore. They might kind of forget periodically about a constitutional ruling from the Supreme Court. But generally speaking, presidents have followed Supreme Court rulings.
With the role of the Supreme Court being the interpreter of the law, how do we end up with legislation from the bench?
Well, that's part of judicial review. There are different philosophies for when and how the Supreme Court should act on a certain law. And justices who generally tend to follow activist philosophies wherein they think it's their job to interpret the law and to rule on the law based on their own personal viewpoint that leads to new laws kind of being created. Restrainists do it as well, originalist, constitutionalist, whatever term you want to use, but it has to do with how these rulings are written. Very often it's not just the government can't do this, it's instead the government has to do something else, and that's where case law comes into play.
Okay. With civil rights, in the podcast, you went through several rulings that seemed to kind of reflect American society at the time.
Yes.
Is that fair to say? And then with the Brown versus Board of Education, we saw a lot of things corrected and righted according to the actual law. What caused the change in the Supreme Court to look at the Constitution as a whole and say, you know, this is actually unlawful? The ruling before that came before was not constitutionally sound.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just a reflection of society, or is it the court being honest about what the Constitution actually is saying?
That's a really good question. I think with the three cases that I mentioned, four if you count Loving, which we'll maybe talk about at the end, but the three big civil rights cases are, of course, Dred Scott, Plessy, and Brown. With Dred Scott, it was actually not reflective of public mores. It was one person predominantly, Roger Taney, the Supreme Court Chief Justice, interpreting the law and the Constitution through the lens of his passionate, deeply held racism and pro-slavery beliefs. The American people were still very bitterly divided. This is in 1857, 3 years before the Civil War. They're still bitterly divided on the issue of slavery, and Dred Scott, in many ways, is kind of the final push towards civil war. Because at that point, the kind of consensus of, all right, we're going to decide this eventually down the line as a political matter is completely taken away. An unelected judge told the northern half of the country, slavery is now legal in your territories. If a southerner brings a slave from a southern state into a northern state, that person is still enslaved. Whereas before, that was not the case, depending on the state. A couple states still allowed it, but it was made so on a national basis. So that was one person's interpretation, not regardless of what the Constitution said, because the Constitution doesn't address the issue of who is and is not a citizen until the 14th Amendment. And then when it comes to Plessy, that was reflective of public mores to an extent, because while segregation was mainly in the South, it was at least somewhat popular in northern states. So there was kind of a national consensus on southern states being able to segregate, and Plessy kind of upheld that. The problem is, if you read the 14th Amendment on paper, and I want to stress that, separate but equal might be constitutional, but in practice, and this is something I kind of touched on in the podcast, but I'm glad you asked about this, you can have separate facilities as long as they receive equal funding. Well, equal funding can mean many, many things.
Right, right.
And as we talked about the first time we went over this subject, and I would encourage people to go back and listen to the discussion at least, the podcast is the same, just with better audio quality. But in the original discussion, we talked about how southern states would, for example, with schools, they would look at the funding for black and white schools, and they would say, well, this many textbooks times this cost, it's the same, it's equal funding. But the textbooks themselves were of wildly different quality. They were older, they were falling apart. Same thing with desks, chalkboards, everything that the school had. On paper, yes, it's equal, but in practice, no. The outcomes of these kids' education was vastly unequal. And that was one of the key elements in the 1950s that led people to say, you know, we've had this whole experience in the Second World War and the building racism and anti-racism that's been going alongside that. We need to start looking at outcomes in addition to opportunity. And that balance of outcomes and opportunities is one of the ways that we get Brown versus Board of Education, which says that separate but equal is inherently unequal unless you can get relatively similar outcomes in segregated schools, which, based on how the South segregated at the time, you could not.
With that said, the Dred Scott ruling in the Supreme Court, earlier we were talking about the ability or inability of the Supreme Court to enforce its ruling. Mm-hmm. When the Supreme Court ruled on Dred Scott in that terrible way, is the onus, the moral onus, just as much on the executive branch for enforcing it as it is on the Supreme Court?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And okay. President Buchanan had no problem with the ruling. He certainly agreed with it. I don't know to what level it was actually enforced because it's only 3 years. And given the kind of slower pace of information being disseminated across the country, I don't know how many slaves were brought into the North before that final breach occurred with Lincoln's election and the first shots being fired at Fort Sumter. And then all the northern states abolishing any law that protected slave owners in their states. Like
so
that.
Lincoln takes office. He does not enforce that law.
It remains on the books until the 14th Amendment is passed in 1868, I believe it is.
Okay.
But he does not enforce it, and neither does President Johnson.
Okay.
Because with the 13th Amendment, slavery is now illegal. But it did leave the question for those, I think it was 1868, those 3 to 5 years between the 13th and the 14th Amendment, there was still a question of, okay, African Americans are now free, they're no longer slaves, but what is their legal status? And that's why we get the 14th Amendment that says if you are born on U.S. soil, you are a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And therefore are entitled to equal protection under the law.
So would it be fair to say then with Plessy versus Ferguson, it was the same type of arrangement? Like it was still the executive branch enforcing what the Supreme Court had ruled on?
Yes, in this case, the state executive branches, not the federal. Because under the 10th Amendment, education is left to the states. Park access is left to local communities. Bathroom policy and like drinking fountain access, those are all left to local authorities.
So you had some states that,
It's one of the reasons why segregation lasts so long is the 10th Amendment is very, very clear. And at the time, there was much more of a clear dividing line between federal and state power than there is today. So every president from 1896, it would have been from William McKinley straight through to Dwight Eisenhower, now implementing Brown, with varying levels of success, some of them tried to challenge segregation, but it was still largely a states' right issue. And some presidents, most famously the progressive hero and icon Woodrow Wilson, actually agreed with it and continued to enforce it and actually expanded segregation in the federal government.
Interesting. So some states did not enforce that rule. Some states...
Northern states did not.
Okay.
Well, okay. That's actually not true. some northern states and some northern communities did segregate. But by and large, once we get into the, like the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, that starts to go away. But it is true that it was not just in the South. Some northern states did allow local communities to segregate their schools if they wanted to.
So backing up a little bit, John, and I'm expecting this shoe to be thrown because I have a what-if question.
Oh, no. Yeah. Here we go.
First one of the season, actually. So, Mark.
That's true. It is.
You know, here's the moment.
Okay.
If Lincoln had not been assassinated and Reconstruction was allowed to take place, we have seen? I know that the evil of racism would still have to be combated over time.
Yes.
It wasn't going to be done away with by force. Slavery was, mm-hmm. thank God, but it's like there still was going to be those terrible viewpoints held in the South. How would Reconstruction have benefited or have accelerated and changed our society from what happened to what could have happened?
Well, it entirely depends on who succeeds Lincoln as president. Assuming that Lincoln is able to serve out his second term and doesn't run for a third term, which we could have if he wanted to, but assuming he does the two-term precedent following George Washington and all the other presidents who are elected to two terms, if he is followed by Andrew Johnson, which is actually pretty unlikely. Johnson was a Democrat. He was chosen to run with Lincoln in 1864 as kind of a unity ticket to bring the country together in the aftermath of the Civil War. I doubt he would have been elected after that. So if another Republican, maybe Grant, who knows, had followed him and had the same passionate commitment to a peaceful Reconstruction, and if the federal government had enforced laws against paying freed slaves, pennies on the dollar, as they did with sharecropping, which were on the books, technically. But again, 10th Amendment, they were just ignored by state and local governments. And thirdly, if the federal government was able to get a handle of the carpetbaggers, these northern businessmen and northern politicians who would go down there and take advantage of the absolute misery of Southerners, especially in Georgia after Sherman's March and in other states, just to make a quick buck, that generated serious anti-northern, not specifically pro-segregation, but they just hated these northerners. If all three of those took place, and if federal troops could have been in the South for another 15, 20, 30 years, keeping the peace, you don't have the rise of the KKK or anything like that, then maybe we could have addressed the social aspects of racism, prevented the rise of segregation at the time. Unfortunately, I think given the importance of states' rights at the time, and states' rights is important, but civil rights is more important. I don't want to say that I'm 100% pro states' rights. You don't get to oppress your people simply because they're of a different skin color, gender, race, whatever. I think that as the memory of the Civil War and the memories of slavery died off in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, there would still have been some measure of rising segregation because, unfortunately, racism is pervasive in America at that time, in the North and the South. So I do think you would still see some kind of separation between the races, maybe not legally enforced, but probably socially, at least for a time. So standard answer to a what-if question, I don't know.
It could go several ways.
Could go either way.
It's one of those things where I wonder what if, because I hope it would have been better.
I do too.
I hope it would have been better, and even though it's a what-if, and even though it didn't happen, the idea of a better Reconstruction of some kind affecting change in a positive way is just great to think about.
Yeah, I agree.
So. All right, so time for some audience questions.
Excellent.
Yeah. So thank you again to all of you. Send us questions. Please continue to do so. We really love to have that interaction. The first question comes from Christopher. Thank you so much for sending this in. Do you think the Supreme Court should be an agent of societal change in America?
I think to correct very serious wrongs, yes. But in my opinion, it needs to operate within the framework set down in the Constitution. It needs to be getting our laws closer and closer and closer to what the Constitution actually says. Now, that's a political point. Others will have different opinions, but in my view, it is up to the legislature, the elected branch of government at the national level and in the states, especially, and this is one area where states' rights, I think, does still have some relevance, to address very serious social changes that are not distinctly within the boundaries of the Constitution. So an example, a popular example on the political right, I'm not saying this to cause, you know, discord or anything like that within our audience or anger towards me. But if you look at the Dobbs case regarding abortion, a lot of people on the right, a lot of pro-lifers said that the Supreme Court absolutely should have reversed Roe v. Wade because it falls under the rubric of basic constitutional rights, the right to life. other people have a different view. Again, I'm not here to discuss or debate that. I think Joe and I are probably, actually, I don't want to speak for Joe, so I won't say that. But when it comes to the court acting, it should be to get us closer to our founding document, which is, yes, its flaws, is a pretty good one and that has held this country together, with the exception of the Civil War, and allowed it to prosper immensely over the last two centuries. Let the legislature deal with social questions that are outside the Constitution. That's my view.
Okay. This question came from a few people. Do you support the idea or believe that the justices should have term limits?
Oh, that's a good question.
And I will add on to that and why.
That's a really good question. I mean, I see both sides. I think historically, it's really tempting for me to give a political answer because of how politicized the court has become in the last 30, 40 years. I tend to think that no, justices should be allowed to serve on good behavior. I do think that if the American people expressing their will through the legislative branch has a problem with a justice, I do think we should impeach justices more often.
Yeah.
But generally, the idea of term limits makes the process of selecting a new justice even more political than it already is. Because let's say it's 10 years. Well, 10 years from now, that president knows that he or she is going to be appointing one, two, three justices, whatever it is. And so they're going to tailor their campaigns even more to that than they already do. And I would like to keep the justices and the Supreme Court as apolitical as possible. It's obviously not possible anymore, but let's not make it even more politicized than it already is.
Yeah.
How about you? What do you think?
I believe so. I think that
they should have term limits.
Yeah, I think that term limits are becoming more and more attractive as we get more and more political.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
true.
It's really a hard question with the Supreme Court because it's easy to side on the partisan line to say, well, I want my justices, the ones that I agree with, to stay on the bench,
yeah,
and I don't want others to. Well, it's got to be one way or the other. I can't like pick and choose. So I would be, if pressure tested, I could go either way, actually.
Can we agree that members of Congress should have term limits?
100%.
Agreed.
Yes, absolutely. It helps to get back out into the world, out of that city.
It really does.
Yeah. A question from Sandy, one from Christopher. For each of us, I'm going to ask myself as well. Do you think the Supreme Court should allow cameras in the court? I have an answer. I have my own answer, but I was curious what you think.
I'll have to think about that for a second. Give me your answer.
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I don't want it to turn into entertainment, and I don't want it to turn into like a real-time blow-by-blow thing where people can react to it. I think it's better. More information requires more responsibility, and we've, as of late, shown that we don't have a lot of that. So I think it'd be better to not.
Well, and I think I tend to agree with you because you don't want the justices trying to turn themselves into media stars any more than some of them already do. And we already get transcripts. We already know everything that is said. I guess the only reason why I would want cameras in there is to get like live reaction. But again, is that always a good idea? I would say no. Sometimes it's good to have full information, but maybe take some time and think and pause and reflect.
Yeah. Christopher sent us another question and several echoed it. What is the most important or your favorite Supreme Court case that most people haven't heard of?
Oh, that's a good one. I'm tempted to say D.C. versus Heller, 2008, because it involves one of my favorite pastimes, which is firearms. I have two. Actually, that's not true. I just have one. Miranda v. Arizona, 1966, in which the Supreme Court ruled that when police officers arrest you, they have to inform you of your 5th, 6th, 7th, and 14th Amendment constitutional rights. You have the right to remain silent, etc. I think that gets us closer to the Constitution, and I think all of us agree that it's important for criminals to at least be aware of their rights. Do you have a favorite?
Brown versus Board of Education is probably my favorite one.
Oh, well, okay, sorry. I guess if we're including the ones that the really, really good one that was in the podcast,
yeah,
yes,
yeah,
that's up there as well.
The question was specifically the ones you haven't heard of.
Yeah.
I just. One final question from me.
Yes. Although I much more enjoy like hearing audience questions. I don't want to talk to you. I've been talking to you for 4 years, man.
No kidding.
People, send us more questions.
I don't blame you.
I'm kidding. No, I feel the same way about you.
It's totally old. Anyways, in this politically charged environment, when the Supreme Court makes a decision, it is blown up on every channel, every site.
When they make a big one, yes.
Yeah,
most Supreme Court decisions don't get right. any kind of media coverage.
Recently, though, a lot of them have been big. So regardless of what news agency you subscribe to, it becomes a huge deal. What is a better practice? If you're really interested in knowing what was said in the ruling, what would you suggest our audiences do?
So if you are someone who has kind of a background in legal terminology, I am not a lawyer, but I've read enough and studied enough history to understand a lot of the legal terms, and it's really, you don't have to get a history degree or an education degree or anything like that to do this. Read the decisions. A lot of media, heck, all media, spins court decisions to generate clicks and to generate views. Again, just because it's fresh in people's minds, the Dobb case. Within minutes of the court issuing its ruling, half of the media establishment said abortion is now illegal in every state. That's not what the court said. Flip it around. There have been instances, for example, when U.S. v. Windsor was decided. Half of the media said, oh my gosh, there are going to be gays getting married in every public facility in the country. Not true. Both sides of the media will spin the court's decisions to get their side riled up. My view, read the decision itself. Most Supreme Court decisions are not that long. Yes, they're dense with a lot of legal terminology, but a layman can understand them. The clerks who write the decisions and with the input of the justices, they do their best to make it understandable for people who are not legal scholars. And then also, I mean, find sources that you trust. There were some on the right and the left who got the interpretation and the analysis of the court right. So within this vast media sphere, and we have millions of people who all they do now is offer commentary, find people that not just that you trust because you like them or because they vote the way you do or they say the kinds of things that appeal to your political senses, find people who have a track record of getting things right. One of the ones who I really trust, I don't always agree with his analysis, but he's pretty spot on when it comes to almost every legal opinion, is Alan Dershowitz. I read his stuff when it comes to Supreme Court rulings. I think he's wrong on a lot of things in terms of how he approaches the law. But when it comes to just reading, here's what a Supreme Court decision says, he's almost always spot on. Another one is Jonathan Turley. Both of them are good, honest legal scholars who believe their job is to inform the public rather than to enrage the public in one way or another.
So, John, one last question again from Christopher.
Keep them coming, man.
Yeah.
You're awesome.
Should there be restraints on the role of the courts in regard to individual rights? And I think that that's an interesting question because, as you talked about earlier, the role of the court is not to restrict rights one way or the other. The role of the court is to interpret the law. So when that role is abused and individual rights are hindered...
Or expanded.
Either way. Where is the restraint? Is it in the other branches of government? How do you balance that?
That's a really good question. I'm liking this Christopher guy and his deep thoughts here. This is excellent. I would say, and again, this is an opinion, the Constitution exists within the framework of the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence itself rests on three fundamental natural rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness or property,
depending on how you
interpret that. So when it comes to individual rights, if you are restricting an individual's right to life, the right to liberty, or their right to the pursuit of happiness, in which Jefferson meant the fruits of their labor. That's what it was. It's not just, oh, I do drugs, therefore I'm happy, so the government can't tell me I can't be happy. That's not the point of that clause. When it comes to restricting those rights, or any of the rights that flow out of it, they'd better have a darn good reason. I do not think that the Supreme Court, or any branch of government, ought to restrict rights, individual rights generally, unless exercising those rights inflicts definite harm on another person. And definite harm should be determined by the legislative branch, not by the court. Because you and I might have different interpretations of what constitutes harm. We might have different interpretations than each other. We certainly would have different interpretations of harm than some of the people on Twitter.
Well, yeah, and that certainly came to pass with COVID.
Yes. With COVID, with free speech, there's any number of examples of this. I think it should be up to the legislative branch, the branch that most closely reflects or should reflect the will of the American people, to determine where the boundaries on exercising rights should be. If we put it to the Supreme Court, that takes it out of the political discourse. And America is a country that should be operating as much of these big, huge questions. If we're going to have a role for government at all, it should be democratically decided where the boundaries of exercising civil rights, individual rights, natural rights should be. if there's going to be a boundary set by government, it should be decided democratically. The other option is having one person in the White House or 535 people in Congress or 9 unelected people in the courts deciding. Democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others, Winston Churchill famously said. I happen to agree with him.
Yeah.
So if we're going to have government limiting rights, it should be done by democratic consent.
So if a Supreme Court rules a specific way where it does limit rights and we're upset about it, our focus should be on getting our representatives to push against that with some kind of law.
Well, the problem is that if the Supreme Court has immense power when it comes to their rulings, the only way to change a Supreme Court's ruling is either A, have another court down the line, a future court, reverse the ruling, like we saw with Dobbs, reversing Roe v. Wade, or amending the Constitution. The Supreme Court cannot strike down a constitutional amendment. So to an extent, I mean, yes, we should be putting pressure on our elected representatives, but there's not a whole lot that they can do. If they pass a law reversing a Supreme Court decision, the Supreme Court will simply strike it down and say, no, you can't do that. So again, that's why I think take it out of the Supreme Court realm, keep it in the political realm, so at least there can be discussion and we can, as social mores and values change over time, our laws can change over time to reflect that. Freezing something at a certain point based on a certain medical or political or social or climate or whatever understanding is really, really dangerous, in my opinion. And history teaches us that.
Yeah, you went over a lot of examples of just that in the podcast. Thank you for joining us in our discussion of civil rights in the Supreme Court. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. And if you would like to make our podcast even better, please go to 15minutehistorypodcast.org and hit the support button. Thank you, and see you next week.